Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest series of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, Mike Parry, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this fine moment?
I am excellent, Michael. How are you today?
Very well indeed, thank you. And I have to say, your voice is sounding as mellifluous. Is that the right word?
Mellifluous. It's quite hard to say first thing in the morning.
It is quite hard to say first thing in the morning. I shall have to wait till I have my first drink of the day and then try it again. That'll be after lunch. Now, Ms. Jones, of course, this podcast is to entertain and inform. So I'm sorry we've got to kick off with a very serious subject today, but it's the subject at the moment that everybody's talking about, and that is the safety of women on the streets following the horrific murder of the lady who took a walk home from Clapham Common towards Balham, but of course never got there. This is a most horrendous happening with really, really serious repercussions. Would you not agree?
It's touched us all, hasn't it? As it was unfolding on the television, the story, we all sat there just entranced with horror, really. I've got two daughters myself. I have a niece. I know you have a couple of sisters yourself. You know, everyone is touched by this because we all have women in our lives, and of course more than half of us are women, so it's all the old arguments come back up. Women are attacked by men are not attacked by women, so there is an imbalance before we start. My son raised the point over the weekend that yes, men do get attacked on the streets, but one of my daughters then said yes, but not by women. So males are the predators, I'm afraid, and I don't mean to give all men a bad name.
No, I totally accept it.
The vast majority of men, I'm sure, are perfectly safe to be around. But the fact is, this woman was murdered.
Of the incident itself, I am so horrified because, believe it or not, you just mentioned my niece, right? My niece is in her early 30s. She's a girl about town. She's just moved into her first flat she's ever bought in Battersea, okay? Battersea, as those who want to be posh call it. And she's probably a 10-minute walk away from where this happened, OK? She's lived in flats around Clapham Common. It's one of her favourite areas. She goes to Clapham Common, where the journey started for the lady we're talking about, Sarah. What was her name? Sarah Everson, is it? Yeah.
Sarah Everard.
Everard, I beg your pardon, yeah. No disrespect. You know, it just sent a shockwave down my back because my niece is about 5'5" or something like that, you know, 5'6". She's a petite girl. She's very, very streetwise. She doesn't, you know, let anything worry her. She's a girl who will go out at night when we're all allowed to go out at night again. And it truly horrified me. And I can imagine you've had the same horrendous, you know, nightmare thoughts with your daughters.
Well, of course. And to everybody who has said, why the hell didn't she take a cab? Well, it's her right to walk home at 9:30 at night. Yeah. She preferred not to use public transport because of coronavirus and because of the safety aspect of that. Yeah. I suppose the similar argument could be applied to taking Ubers or black cabs. You know, you just are safer walking. She preferred to walk. Yeah. Why shouldn't she walk? Nobody would question a man for choosing to walk. That is not late at night, 9:30. No. And there are plenty of cars, plenty of traffic, plenty of people around on that road alongside Clapham Common at that time of night. One would think that that was a very safe walk to make.
Yes.
And it's absolutely horrifying what's happened.
You know, I didn't understand the mentality that women have to adopt when they're out on the streets. But I've got a friend called Aisha Hazarika, and she's a sort of political pundit. And I've worked with her on lots of shows, Jeremy Vine and radio and all that kind of stuff. And she once, you know, I used to tell her about the girls in New York who used to travel to work in their trainers, but then swap them for high-heeled shoes in their glitzy, you know, glass and silver offices. And I said, I suppose that just, it's because it's more comfortable, is it? She said, no, all women do that. I said, yeah, so if it's not for comfort, why is it? She said, so we can run if we get attacked on the way home. I mean, and, you know,
It's not only, you know, it's not that we're changing into high heels and so on when we get to an office or a film studio, whatever. Now, we are wearing trainers all the time. All of us do. Because, yes, it makes it easier to escape. Yeah. That is an important appalling indictment on our society.
Of course it is. But the other appalling thing is, for years, right, on the walking bit, that lady, Sarah, could have walked because she wanted to keep herself fit in lockdown. That's what I do. I walk. I try to walk for an hour a day, every day, OK? And I get out there and I love walking. It gives me a feeling of, you know, enhancement and, you know, your pores open up and all that kind of stuff. It's a great feeling. And she probably wanted to do that. But what I've never considered are the number of, you know, reports I've heard from women over the last two or three days that every time a woman hears the sound of footsteps coming up behind her, and it's clearly a man because he's heavier and the footsteps are heavy, they bristle with, you know, the thought that the next thing that might happen is a pair of hands might go around your throat. What an appalling way to live your life.
Well, it really is. And, you know, unfortunately, what do we do to stamp this out?
Yeah.
We have to get all men on side. We have to stop objectifying women for a start.
Yeah.
And yes, this sounds political, but it's the truth. If we continue to have establishments such as strip clubs and lap dancing clubs in our cities and towns, all of which fuels the fire, all of which maintains the idea that women are for nothing else than sex, you know, until that day, yeah, until we establish genuine equality between the sexes so that men do not see women as there for the taking, yeah, anymore, we, yeah, will not stamp out this kind of thing.
Well, look, it's a huge argument that I'll tell you for sure. I've never been to a strip club or a lap dancing club in my life. I once turned round and left a mate's outdoor birthday party because the special surprise was topless waitresses, and I thought it was so undignified and, you know, dreadful sort of behaviour. And I'm a big supporter of women's rights, and problem is, whilst women are prepared to become lap dancers because they're paid money to do it, usually by men, then I don't know how the problem's going to be eradicated. Now, I want to put to you, Ms. Jones, a revolutionary idea I've got. In the same way that women over the years, over the decades, over the centuries have banded together as women to do good, men have never really done that. So the war, you know, the women's royal voluntary service started to aid those who were needing help, you know, young mothers in poverty, all that kind of stuff, you know, cooking down at the WRVS and all that kind of stuff. Men have never banded together to try and help anybody. I don't think there's any voluntary organisations which comprise are comprised of men. I mean, there are a few charities, you know, like the entertainment charities you'll know about, you know what I mean? The Lord's Taverners and all that kind of stuff.
But what the Variety Club and so on. But what, yes, about the Royal British Legion, for example? That, well, seems to have men in it.
Yes, it does. But the Royal British Legion is specifically for men who've served in the military. You see what I mean? So it's really a bonding of those who've, you know, either fought for their country or served for their country or something like that. But I wonder whether we should now start thinking, I've got to, you know, get this thought into some sort of order, but can't men band together and start some sort of organisation which could be called something like Men for Women or Men Protect Women or something like that? And we should have groups in local areas who band together, who could be available because communications are so good these days, a text, a phone call, an email or something like that. And if a woman is coming to a station at 10 o'clock at night and has to walk home from there or is worried, she should be able to call out somebody, a bit like those angels that popped up in New York in the 1980s, you know, the what were they called?
They were vigilantes, weren't they?
Well, I don't know. They got on the subways, didn't they? And there was, you know, a huge increase in crime on the underground in New York. And all of a sudden, what were they called? Something angels came along.
Yeah, they were the angels, but they were attacking people. And there was quite a lot of controversy attached to
them. Oh, yeah. I thought they were supposed to protect people. No, I didn't
know. Completely illegal organisation.
Yeah, well, OK, not like that. But, I wouldn't want people to wear a paramilitary uniform like they did. I'm talking about men making themselves available to assist women, to try and, you know, rid women of the fear of just being on our streets. I remember a couple of years ago, Caitlin Moran, and we've always argued over how you pronounce her name, but
I think she'd resist the idea of being Caitlin Moron. I think she's Kathleen Moran is her name.
Moran, okay, well, that's it, yeah. A couple of years ago, I read a column from her in which she raised this very issue. She said, just imagine men out there, if there was a big hairy beast lurking around every corner who could attack you, that's how women feel about men in society. And, you know, she made the point that, of course, every man's not a predator, but one man could be, as is illustrated by this terribly tragic case.
I think what you're suggesting is, you know, good-hearted, and it's a fundamental level a good idea, but it still perpetuates this idea that we as women are not able to protect ourselves, that we are at the mercy of men, even if those men are there to come out and escort us or protect us, we are still not doing it for ourselves, and we should not live in fear. We should not have to worry about walking down a dark street. The other night I came home by myself, having installed my daughter in a new house up in North London, and she'd given me her keys to this house because she no longer needed them. She put them in the little kind of well thing between the two front seats in the car, you know. So I came in, and I always do what I always do. I did what I always do. Came in the gate, glanced around the garden, sort of fearfully glanced at the bins and thought, who's hiding behind there? Put my key in the door, ran in, slammed the front door and locked it, and then made a cup of tea, then realized that I'd left those keys that she'd given me in the car. In full view of the street. So then I'm panicking. Anyone could now look in my car, which is parked right outside my front garden, realize that those keys are probably the keys that open this house. They could let themselves in and murder me. So I then had to go through the whole trauma of now going back outside in the dark, down the garden path to my car to retrieve those keys, feeling terrified to do this.
In your own garden? In your own
front
garden?
In my own front garden on my own street. But yes, because you never know who is lurking. Now, a man would run out there and retrieve those keys without even thinking about it.
No, I totally agree. I mean, you know, I didn't realise I lived such a different life in my head to women. I have no fear of going out. You know, some nights I'd have been sitting here watching the telly when we lived in the normal world and thought, I can't stand any more of this. I'm going down the pub. You know what I mean? And I just put on my coat and I walk outside. I walk down the dark street I live in and then turn right and walk down a dark sort of main road. You know, pub's only 5 minutes away. But of course, a woman can't do that, can she?
Well, here's another thing. When can a woman walk into a pub at night by herself, order a drink at the bar and sit down and have it? Everyone is looking at her thinking, what's she doing here by herself? Is she on the pickup? You know,
I totally
there is
agree.
A different attitude. We can't just wander into a pub, even during the daylight hours, have a drink by ourselves.
I totally agree with you. But anyway, this has highlighted. And of course, the behaviour of the police at that vigil on Saturday night was absolutely disgraceful. It wasn't a protest. It was a vigil. I saw the lady whose face is now on the front of every newspaper. Her name's Patsy. And she had a mask on and copper hair. And she's looking up into the camera. My God, I saw her talking on television, and it was absolutely disgraceful, I'm telling you.
A friend of mine who's a young journalist, Sophie Wilkinson, she went down to Clapham Common, and she said it was just a peaceful vigil. Nothing was going on. She said, but then I chose to leave just as the police were arriving. So it's very clear that the police force inflamed the scenario and turned it into something else. Had they just been left to get on with it, what harm are a bunch of women going to do? You know, they're all there to make a point collectively. This has to stop. We cannot live like this anymore. And men cannot assume that because we're walking around a street late, well, not even late at night, at night in the dark, that we are there for the taking. We are not.
It was disgraceful the way that vigil was handled. It was outdoors. I mean, there's no recorded cases of people catching COVID outdoors. When everybody got onto the beaches at Bournemouth and Brighton, when, you know, lockdown was lifted last year, there was no spike at all because it blows away in the wind. And it's been very windy the last two or three days. I can't see there could have been any problem there. The police should have allowed the vigil. They should have said, please socially distance, which I'm sure all the women would. They only wanted to be there for 10 minutes to put a candle down and then they'd have been away. But Cressida Dick, who runs the Metropolitan Police, I mean, she should step down. She's no good at it. This is a woman who's also in charge of Operation Midland, which led to that idiot Carl Beach, who's now serving 18 years, to lodge accusations of murder against politicians and all that. Never once did she think, this sounds a bit fishy. I mean, anyway, look, another story.
So Priti Patel is her boss, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So why doesn't Priti Patel fire her?
I don't know. I certainly would. I think she's completely inept. Anyway, look, that's all terribly worrying and something that we're going to have to address in society. Let's go from that to a really, really uplifting story. And I'm talking about the London Academy called Brampton Manor in East London, one of the poorest areas of the country, actually, one of the poorest areas of London, who's had more sixth form pupils given offers to go to Oxford and Cambridge than Eton College, which has a sixth form the same size. Isn't that fantastic?
Well, it is, but it's also positive discrimination. And this has been going on for a few years now.
Right.
And there is a feeling, there certainly was this feeling among my children, two younger children's generation, that there was something slightly untoward, a bit iffy about going to Oxford or Cambridge. So they went to public schools, but they were resisting the idea of going to Oxbridge because of the connotation. So I think this has been preempted. And I think those two universities have gone out into the field and they have deliberately looked outside of the public school arena to broaden their remit, if you like.
Right. And so, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's both.
Right.
Because there is a social aspect to this, which they're presumably trying to stamp out. The notion that Oxford and Cambridge offer posh kids from wealthy backgrounds who went to fee-paying schools, who have not only the advantage of a more expensive education, but all the peripheral benefits, such as the sport, the drama, the trips abroad, the, you know, all the things that you don't get in your average state school, I suppose.
So, I totally agree.
It seems to be a symbiotic arrangement is what I'm driving at.
Yeah, well, A, they want to make it more inclusive, Oxford and Cambridge, and I can't possibly argue with that. That's fantastic. B, you're absolutely right, they want to get rid of the elitist. But I don't want the elitist element of Oxford and Cambridge to be removed, because I want Oxford and Cambridge to remain two of the great universities of the world and produce the sort of people who are going to end up running this country, considering I think 18 prime ministers have come from Oxford, including the current one, Boris Johnson, and the former one, David Cameron. So I'm all for that. I would love to have gone to Oxford, and in fact,
I just rewind you there?
Yeah,
that
sure.
is a horrifically elitist thing to say, Mike.
Why?
I'm sorry, because you're saying that only posh rich people can run the country.
No, I'm saying that's a fact that 18 former prime ministers, including the current one, have come out of Oxford or Cambridge.
Yeah, well, that doesn't make that a good thing.
Well, it does if they rise to the status of prime minister, because...
Okay, so give me a list of the prime ministers who have failed miserably in the job, including the current one.
Well, John Major, for instance, didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge. He was a grammar school
boy. Well, so you can't count him then. So he's off your list.
Oh, he's
not on
your list
even to begin with.
Yeah. No.
What would you say about David Cameron, who threw in the towel the minute he was cornered for having made a mistake?
I thought David Cameron was pretty useless. David Cameron didn't...
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're suggesting that all they need to do is to have gone to Eton, Oxford and Cambridge to be prime minister. And then that's brilliant, because that's where they rose up from. But so many of them have failed on the job.
Yes, they have. I totally agree. But all I'm saying is that I do like the elitist element of it, because we've got to have elite academic institutions, because if we don't, the country will fall behind.
Well, okay. So you're not making the distinction, may I say, between academic achievement and the social element of this. So you can, yes, their job, Oxford and Cambridge and other universities in that league, their job is to preserve academic excellence.
Yes, definitely.
That's all they're interested in, the creme de la creme. But you can come from a council estate and be the most intelligent person in the country. So that has nothing to do with your social background.
Of course you can. But if you are from a council estate and you get the opportunity to go to Oxford, that's a brilliant thing. And I watched some of those kids talking about it this morning. One of them said she was going there to do PPE. And that's what David Cameron did, politics, philosophy and economics. And it's the all-embracing sort of degree. You know, he got a first-class degree, much to the chagrin of Boris Johnson, who only got a 2-1 in classics. But I went to Oxford for an interview to do PPE at Brasenose, which was David Cameron's college. But for some bizarre reason, they didn't want me. I mean, can you figure that out?
Well, you didn't do your A-levels, did you?
Well, I did, yeah, but I didn't get very good grades. But they didn't
That's obviously why. Well, no. Sorry to break it to you, chum.
No, they didn't even give me an offer. That's what I mean. So
because your A-level results weren't good enough.
No, they usually
give you
an offer before your A-levels and say, right, if you get, you know, 3 A's or 2 A's and a B, we'll take you. They just didn't give me an offer. I couldn't work it out.
What were your mocks results like?
We didn't do mocks at my school. It was too good a school. We were too bright.
What were the predictions? Like, you must have had predictions of some kind to give an idea of how you might do.
No, I don't think so. Honestly, I think it was... Anyway, there we are. Point is that I ended up at the University of Trent, but only lasted a year anyway. And there we are. Now, have you ever been associated with a bald man, Leslie Ann?
What, romantically, you mean?
Well, in any way, you know, I think that men who are bald are, well, I just don't like the appearance of a bald man. It unsettles me. I think a human head looks better with hair. So I've got great sympathy for people who lose their hair because of natural, you know, baldness. My dad was bald when he was 28. But I don't think going around shaving your head and all that kind of stuff is a very good look. And I'm glad that my prejudice has been held up by a report which says bald guys have a problem getting on in life. I just wonder what your image of the bald man is.
We'd better tell Prince William, hadn't we?
Prince William's not bald. He's going bald. Yeah.
Pretty much bald. He looks much better in a hat, I have to say. But I have a little list for you.
Oh, yes.
Okay. This goes way back. Right. We're showing our age here. Telly Savalas.
Yeah.
Yul Brynner. James Taylor went bald. Andre Agassi. Yeah. Moby, the techno artist. Yes. Jason Statham. Yeah. Sir Patrick Stewart. Bruce Willis. Matt Lucas.
Yeah.
Pablo Picasso. Mm. Dwayne Johnson, otherwise known as The Rock. Yeah. Michael Jordan. I mean, how many do you want me to fling here?
But that doesn't mean I find them any more attractive as bald. The fact that they're a bit successful. Look, baldness is a fashion thing now, isn't it? I mean, I can't understand why men would want to shave their hair off their head. It's just madness.
I don't think any of the aforementioned shave their heads. I think they went bald naturally.
Oh, I think Yul Brynner probably did, by the look of it, I would say.
Shaved his head?
Yeah, I would think so, wouldn't you?
No, I don't think so at all. I had a look at some pictures of him when he was young, and he did go bald pretty young, actually.
Did he? That doesn't surprise me at all. Do you remember Sage David, was it? Was he the Chancellor before Rishi Sunak?
It was
Sage David or Savid Jarvis or something. But anyway, the point is, Sajid Javid.
I think it was Sajid Javid, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, I knew that he would fail as Chancellor when I saw him stand up in the Commons and deliver, you know, I think it was a budget or it might have been a speech. And I thought, I just don't believe a word this man's saying. He is not convincing me of the righteousness of his argument. And the reason why is, I think he looks too inconsequential.
Bald. He looks too bald.
That's right. Too inconsequential to be the
chancellor. That's not his fault. How could you possibly say
this? He shouldn't have been given the job. Though.
What, because he's bald?
Yes, definitely.
That's horrifically baldist.
Well, it might be baldist, but I'm telling you, image is everything in this world. Don't you think that Rishi Sunak, with his wonderful, dark, black, sweeping hair, looks far more credible a figure to run the country's finances than old Sarji, or his name was?
What? So when he goes bald, if the stress of the job makes all his hair fall out, he loses his job?
Well, I would just...
To follow your argument.
No, I would give the job up, because if the stress was getting to you that much, you should give the job up anyway. Seriously, I don't, you know, if I was still in a position of running, you know, media organisations and all that, I would always think twice about hiring bald people.
Well, that's the royal family done for, according to your logic, because Prince William can never become king because he won't have any hair.
But it will look odd, won't it? It will look odd when he's completely bald and he's on the world stage. And I don't mean
Why?
Any disrespect.
That's just appalling of you to say this. Well, I can't believe I'm hearing it.
Well, look, it's only a personal point of view. I wish no ill against people who are bald. I just think, and I'll repeat this, that a human head looks better when there's plenty of hair on it.
So what happens when you lose your hair?
I've already lost quite a lot of it. And all I do is I try to sort of sweep it back, and I wear a Peaky Blinders cap. But actually, I've reached an age in life now where I don't really care, to be honest. But I would have been utterly distraught had I been losing my hair in my 20s or my 30s? I used to work with a guy called Jamie Pyatt, right, at the Sun, lovely fella, and all that. He went bald very early in life, and it can affect you, honestly. It can really affect young men if they start losing their hair too early.
Well, women as well. What would you have said to poor Tessa Jowell, who continued to rock up to the Commons when she was having cancer treatment and had lost all her hair? A lot of people lose their hair because they've been through illness. So we can't be prejudiced against them. I'm sorry, Mike.
No, I have every sympathy for anybody who's lost their hair through illness. I worked with another guy, and you might have done, David Yelland. And David had alopecia as a young man and lost all his hair, and he wore a wig. And then one day he just said, I can't be bothered with this anymore. And he took it off. Now, I've got every sympathy for people like that, for whom a medical condition, but people who make themselves bald, in my view, have got it wrong. Okay, folks, we men love a smooth shave to start the day. So let me tell you about the smoothest, and I mean the smoothest shave I have encountered. It's with Harry's. And from the moment I opened the box, I knew I was in for a special experience. The box that dropped on my doormat, by the way. I'd never seen a razor with a handle shaped like the Harry's razor. The textured grip gives me total guidance around my face. It's a bit like being a downhill skier, if you see what I mean. And the fluffy, foaming shaving gel could have been a snowy slope. Now then, let me tell you. Harry's was started by Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were fed up with overpriced razors and decided to fix shaving. Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure total quality, so they actually bought their own factory. And now, by taking less profit, Harry's offers great quality products for a very fair price. Now, their amazing quality blades are almost half the price of the leading five blade brands, okay? I know that because I've done the research. Now then, Harry's support great causes too by giving 1% of their global sales to non-profit organisations that provide mental health care to men in need. And that is so important. So, give Harry's a go. Start your subscription with a trial set, which includes a weighted ergonomic handle, their new five-blade razor cartridge, rich lathering shaving gel, a travel blade cover to protect your blades on the move, okay? And for a limited time only, stress this, limited time only, if you go direct to harrys.com/porky, you'll also receive a free travel-sized shower gel. Now, all this is worth £14.50. That's £14.50, but you will pay just £3.95. Get the comfortable shave you deserve. Head to harrys.com/porky to claim a trial set for just £3.95. You will also be supporting our podcast by doing so. Again, head to harrys.com/porky today. Right, okay, folks, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky. That's myself and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, as the rock chick writer extraordinaire, I don't suppose the Eurovision Song Contest came into your remit much, did it?
I never covered it, Mike. I never actually went out to whichever country was hosting it that year. There used to be a thing, didn't there, of watching it, having sort of Eurovision watching parties, and you'd get your mates around a few jars and some crisps, and you'd all sit there and watch it. But I think it started to go off the side when we pretty much always came last or second to last.
Hang on. For two decades before that, we pretty much came first or second every year. That was the problem.
Yeah, but if you look at the songs, if you actually examine the songs that used to win, I mean, they're not the kind of songs that have stood the test of time, and nor were the artists, by the way. So I think from our point of view, as the UK, as an entrant, it has had its day. We are never going to climb those charts again. We might as well leave them to it. We're not in Europe anymore.
Well, also, we should cop out, because it's now a political bloc. And certain countries in the eastern part of Europe and certain countries in the economically sounder parts of Europe, they all gang up against us. We hardly ever get any votes. It all started with the envy and the jealousy of congratulations and celebrations and puppet on a string, Sandy Shaw, like a puppet on a string. right? So you recognise those two, obviously. Then there was Lulu.
Well, they're not great songs, though, are they? I mean, they're not the kind of songs.
They were pop songs, weren't they? You know, making your mind up. Just making your mind up. Ooh, that was the one where the girls suddenly unwrapped their skirts, wasn't it?
They wouldn't do that these days. But, I mean, yes, Bucks Fizz, look, they're nice people and stuff. But, again, they're not really my cup of tea. They're not what you'd call a cool kind of rock band with longevity or anything, are they?
No, I agree. But anyway, the reason we're talking about this is because I saw a debate the other day about where is the Eurovision Song Contest going to take place in, you know, the world of COVID and all that kind of stuff. My view is just scrap it. It's a complete... it's a rubbishy mess these days. And usually speaking, what happens is some sort of freak group now win it, you know, like a guitar band with six sparkly guitars or something like that. You know, it's just madness and rubbish. And I they get rid of it.
You never really hear about the songs very much anymore or the artists who win it. You know, they sort of fade away. But where it went wrong for me, completely wrong, was when they started allowing Australia to take part. Since when was Australia anywhere near Europe?
Well, yes, absolutely. Since when did Australia ever produce a decent singer apart from Michael Hutchence and Kylie Minogue? You probably know.
One or two, then.
I was going to say more. But, you know, the other thing that happened was, you know, a lady called Dana won it. All kinds of everything remind me of you. Right? She won it. And she was like, you know, a young Irish girl aged about 18, you know, didn't even really know what she was entering, won it. And then Ireland kept winning it. What happened was, in the end, what happens is whichever country wins it has to host the competition the next year. And Ireland kept winning it. And then they said, we can't afford it anymore. We can't afford to keep hosting the Eurovision Song Contest. We haven't got the budget for it. And so,
well, I thought that was the joke. I think that was kind of deliberate because people went through a sort of anti-Eurovision phase. And, it's like, let Ireland win it. They can host it again next year because nobody else can be asked to do it.
I think that was
the phase that went through. But I'm not interested anymore. I don't know anyone who is. Terry Wogan's gone, God bless him. Graham totally Norton great. We love, but it's not quite the same game. Yeah. I think let it go. Let them get on with it.
Totally agree. Replace it with something else. Talking about rock stars, and we've mentioned this chap before, but I saw a very graphic image of him in the last couple of days. Queen bass player John Deacon. And it's a picture of what looks to be like a little old man, seriously, in a sort of parka coat, right? And he's got like what's left of his hair is snowy white. And he's pictured with a cigarette between his lips, smoking. So the caption is Radio Fag-ar, not Gaga, but Fag-ar, you see what I mean? And it goes on to say, John 69, who wrote Another One Bites the Dust, quit the group when Freddie Mercury died in 1991 and has dodged the band's any participation with the band since. He even didn't attend the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. He was seen smoking in Putney, southwest London. Now, you told me this guy is a recluse, but I also have read in the last couple of days he's made 25 million quid, as has every other member of Queen, from the royalties to the film about Freddie Mercury.
Well, they always say this, don't they? They guess at the figures. Nobody really knows because nobody gets to see the accounts. Nobody knows what kind of contract they have, what kind of cut they have, what the expenses were. It all kind of filters down and boils down. So people look at the box office figures and then they guess at what the individual band members' share might have been. Yeah. They always get it wildly wrong. But the thing is, it's always baffled me why people assume that rock stars can't grow old, which they do, like everybody else.
Yes.
It's not true that John left the band in 1991. He actually quit in 1997. Huh? He took the death of Freddie Mercury very hard because he'd lost his own father when he was 11 and hadn't really grieved. He'd parked it. Yeah. He was the youngest member of the band and he looked up to Freddie as a father figure. Mm-hmm. And in his view, and he stated this publicly, Queen without Freddie Mercury could not continue because Freddie was the heart, the soul, the voice, the essence of Queen.
Yeah.
And in his mind, he couldn't see the point of trying to continue that without Freddie. That was his opinion. So he stepped down. It doesn't mean that he still doesn't reap the rewards of the royalty. pennies from the record sales because he was an integral part of the band. He was a quarter of the band. Yeah. And of course, all members of that band wrote not only hits, but number ones. So his contribution to the band's oeuvre, if you like, was as equal as everybody else's. So of course he gets to earn his share from the sale of the film around the world that came out in 2018. But yes, he's a little old man. Yes, he's growing old, like all the other members of Queen. But because he's not so visible, because he doesn't do things on the world stage, people are shocked when they see pictures of him.
Yes, well, I was as well. Did each member of the band write a number one hit, including the drummer?
Yes. Oh, yes. So Roger Taylor is the drummer. He wrote Radio Gaga, for example.
Yeah, golly, yeah. It's,
I think Freddie must have written the most number ones, I think, but I couldn't give you that figure off the top of my head.
Well,
but yeah, Brian wrote an equal number of songs. You know, they all wrote hits, and that's quite rare in a rock band all the members to write songs equally. Yeah.
I totally agree. I'm a big fan of Matthew Syed. He's a journalist who writes, you know, for all sorts of publications, but he has a regular column in the Sunday Times, as we've discussed before, because he wrote that rather poisonous column about Piers Morgan. Do you remember? You
know, yes, I do.
Piers has got a soapbox and all that. But anyway, he says in his
latest... bald, by the way.
Say again.
He's bald, by the way.
Matthew is, yeah, that's right, yeah. I've had him in my studio.
Just saying.
Yeah, well, he's a former Olympic table tennis player, don't you?
Is that why his hair fell out?
No, Miss Jones. You're now taking the mickey out of me, aren't you?
Yes, a little bit, yeah.
But of course, you could compare his head to a table tennis ball, a ping pong ball, I suppose. But that wasn't immediately there. No, he says, what he says here is, it's quite interesting. There are too many super rich people now, and that spells trouble. When elites grow swollen and opportunities for their children dry up, unrest is inevitable. Now, he goes into a lot of philosophy about it. He's a very bright guy, Matthew. I would call him a philosopher. But his actual first headline, there are too many super rich people, and that spells trouble. This is something that's been worrying me for some time, because I'm thinking the world is getting richer all the time. There are more and more billionaires. There are more people who are super rich, like Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson and, you know, Bill Gates of Microsoft. What's going to happen when they all need a super yacht, when they all need a private aeroplane, when they all need a £10 million home? I mean, the world's going to run out of resources, and those resources are going to be concentrated in a tiny, minute percentage of the world's population.
I'm not so worried about them, but the fact that the world's starving are growing in number.
Yes.
There are more people below the poverty line in existence today than there have ever been. So to the point that in many countries, there's almost no middle class anymore.
Yeah.
You're either super rich or you're extremely poor, especially in countries like India. And that is incredibly worrying. That's what we ought to be doing something about.
Yeah, it's a very good observation. The other country that fits into that bracket is Russia, of course, okay? Because Russia was just carved up by the oligarchs when the Soviet Union collapsed. Literally, whoever was in whoever was in the Kremlin at the time just said, right, come on, fellas, let's help ourselves. Literally, that's what happened, right? And it was Boris Yeltsin who was the architect of all this. Remember Boris? Bouncing,
yes,
Boris.
I
covered a job once in America when Boris Yeltsin came over to see, who would it have been? I think it was Clinton. I think it was Bill Clinton. And it was held in Vancouver, in Canada, on sort of neutral ground, and went up there. And you talk to the people, the security detail around them, who said that Boris Yeltsin is permanently pissed, right? He drinks vodka like other people drink Coca-Cola or water. And half of the receptions that were held on for him, he never went to.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you ever watch The Hairy Bikers?
No.
They were on, I don't know, I was cooking dinner a couple of nights ago and the Hairy Bikers were on TV. And they were in St. Petersburg.
Right.
And they were just going around the streets. They, you know, they cook in the middle of the square and all that kind of stuff. They're quite funny, those guys.
Yeah.
And they were interviewing local people just casually who they came across as they were going about the business, about what it's like living there today as opposed to what it was like during communism.
Right.
And virtually everybody they spoke to said they preferred when they lived under communism, because everybody had a job, such as it was. Everybody had healthcare. Everybody had a place at school. Everybody had a roof over their head. And also everybody had a dacha in the countryside, a little hut or a cottage or some shape. Well, yes, they did. Yes, they visited some of them.
Well, most people lived in cruddy little flats in Moscow. I know, because I've been there.
But they also had, and they went to some of them, and they were very humble. They weren't glamorous places.
Oh, I see, like little sheds, you mean?
Just little countryside cabins where they could go and get away from the filthy city air. Yeah. And all of those people that they interviewed said, yes, they much preferred their life under communism.
Yeah, I've heard that several times. I've been to Russia a number of times. I love Russia. It's a magnificent country. The architecture alone is breathtaking. You know, think of St. Basil's Cathedral on Red Square. Think of the Kremlin with the gold domes. It's absolutely breathtaking country. And fantastic culture. But do you know what? I've heard that so many times. You're so right. They've never had a problem with power or lighting or fuel because they've got so many natural resources. You know, some countries run out of, you know, lighting, run out of power and all that. Never happened in Russia. So they always had a warm home. They always had food on the table. You're absolutely right. They had a job, even though it's for the state, but it was regulated and regimented and nobody went short. The problem with modern Russia is that protective barrier over the vast majority of the population has now disappeared and it has literally become a gangster state. And so people are driven into working in criminality because it's, you know, sometimes often the only way to live. And that's why it's a gangster state.
And that's not progress, is it?
It's not progress at all. But you're absolutely right. But absolutely fantastic country. And, I still like going there just to think about the history of it, you know, the revolution. But one of my favourite ever films is Dr. Zhivago. Now, have you ever heard, Ms. Jones, of a gentleman called Lew Ottens?
Oh, yes, I have, because he's the guy who not only invented the cassette tape, it's a Dutchman, and he also pioneered the creation of CDs.
Yeah.
But what a very interesting guy, because he was born in the 20s and he built his first radio when he was a teenager so that he and his parents could receive Radio Oranje during Germany's wartime occupation of the Netherlands.
I know. Utterly fascinating. The reason I'm talking about him is sadly Mr. Ottens has passed on. He was a ripe old age, in his 90s, I think.
But he was 94.
94, thank you. But he actually, as you quite rightly say, invented the cassette tape. And where would any of us been in our youth without it? We've already had a conversation on this program in the past about the Sony Walkman. Well, he's the guy who made that possible. He gave you freedom to listen what you wanted to listen to anywhere you liked with your earplugs in and an independent source of power to play it. You no longer have to stay in your front room and put a Beatles record on to start listening to all that wondrous music we had in the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Changed our lives, didn't it?
Because
you could literally carry your record collection around with you. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that it was illegal to tape your vinyl onto these cassettes. That was actually against the law, but we all did it.
Oh god,
We could carry our record collection around with us.
We could. A girlfriend of mine, who I went out with, in her flat, we used to listen to Billy Joel. I love Billy Joel, okay?
He's also bald, by the way.
Well, is he? Well, he never
yes,
used to
he
be.
Is.
Never used to be.
Yeah, so well, of course.
That's progress.
No, he never used to be, but that's progress.
And I love some of Billy Joel's great records, you know, and his piano playing and all that kind of stuff. And then for my birthday one year, she came up with the most unique present. She presented me, because I had a Cortina in those days, and a Cortina, no, it couldn't have been a Cortina, that was too early. It was, whatever it was a Sierra or something like that, but it had a cassette player, right? It was the first car I ever had with a cassette player. And, of course, I went out and bought all the Beatles cassettes and all that kind of stuff. But one day for my birthday, she presented me with this cassette, and I said, oh, that's lovely. I said, what is it, a blank cassette? She said, no, I put all the Billy Joel's hits on here. And then next time we went out, you know, we're driving off down to the country or something like that. I was ecstatic that I could listen to Billy Joel's hits one after the other. It was fantastic feeling. And that's all
that
down.
That is great, yeah. And making the mixtapes as people used to make for presents for each other,
yes,
you know?
That's
so,
right.
So all the records that meant something to you as a couple. Yeah. It's lovely that you mentioned Billy Joel, because a great fan of this podcast, who's one of my oldest, dearest friends, Mikey Kiridimu, who lives in Cyprus these days.
Right.
And I don't get to see him nearly enough, but he listens regularly. I love you, Mikey. He was a massive Billy Joel fan. And years ago when I worked at Capital Radio, worked for a guy called Roger Scott, the DJ's DJ, everybody knew and loved Roger. And he had an interview show. He was having Billy Joel in on the show. And Mikey really wanted to meet him. So I was able to talk Roger into allowing us to be in the studio when Billy came in.
Mm-hmm.
And Mikey did a wonderful thing. He bought a bottle of Dom Perignon champagne for Billy Joel because he knew how much he loved that particular mark of champagne. So yeah, I have great memories of meeting Billy Joel. And of course, we went to New York later on and did a little tour of all his locations in New York and so on.
Well, it's funny you should say that, but when I lived in New York, I lived just off First Avenue. I lived between First and York, which is the avenue on the furthest right of Manhattan, as you probably know. And I came out of my place one morning, went round the corner, all the arc lights, because the streets of New York are used all the time, as you know, for films, you know, Romancing the Stone and all that kind of stuff. And they were making the Billy Joel video, Uptown Girl. It was fantastic, honestly. It was just wonderful to see art in action like that.
And I believe that's the video where he met his wife, Christie Brinkley.
He'd already met her, and he made the video so she could star in it, Christie Brinkley.
You're absolutely
right.
Yeah. I remember during that interview that Roger Scott did, we were talking about Christie and about how beautiful she was, and she still is.
She's
in her 60s now, but she looks incredible. And I said, does it ever dawn to you how beautiful your wife is? And Billy Joel went, Christie, she's plain as a piece of bread. And I just thought it was such a wonderful line to come out with. You know, she's the most beautiful woman in the world, probably, at that time.
Yeah. He's very humble, Billy Joel. I've never met him like you have. I never worked in those sort of elevated levels of the world of show business. But all the interviews I've ever read, he often says, hey, I'm just a Jewish kid from Brooklyn made good, you know, and those sort of things. And I love that self-deprecating sort of attitude towards life.
Genius musician as well.
Yeah.
Somebody truly gifted and music worth celebrating always.
He's also got exactly the right idea when he's still doing live shows. And I saw this in an interview with him. He said, I've no intention of writing any more songs. I've no intention of playing any songs on a live show that people don't instantly start tapping their feet to. He said, I go on stage and I play a catalogue of about 20 songs, everyone recognisable to the crowd. That's what they pay their money for. And that's what I'm going to give them. And I think that's a fantastic attitude.
Well, it's what they all do if they've got any sense. I mean, you go to see the Rolling Stones not to hear any new music they might have come up with, but to relive your youth. That's what you're there for.
Yeah, no,
and anyone with any brains is going to do the same.
Yeah, but believe it or not, I don't go to many concerts, but I went to an Elton John one once. Somebody dragged me along. My God, he played 6 songs from his new album, which had, you know, hardly been released. And then we had to wait all the way for an hour and a half to get through all that before he started playing Crocodile Rock and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's a bit tedious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally wrong. I mean, you know, I think...
They need to be greatest hit shows. Those heritage acts need to be greatest hit shows. There's no point going otherwise.
Yes, Rod Stewart actually told me. Rod Stewart is one great pop star I have met. What a delightful guy he is. He's my favourite famous person, Rod Stewart. He's so down to earth. And he said exactly the same. He said, what good would it be me going on to... The trouble with Rod is he's got such a huge back catalogue now because, of course, he did all those lounge LPs that got to number one in America, didn't he?
The Great American Songbook, yes.
That was it, yeah. And I think Rod's problem is he doesn't really know what they want these days. I think he's got two distinctly different audiences. He's got the Great American Songbook, but he's got those who grew up with Maggie May and all that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and those guys don't want to hear his new songs, although he does come out with some occasionally. There was one album about 4 years ago, I can't remember the name of it, pretty cool album. And my friend Steve Harley from Cockney Rebel co-wrote a song that's on that. And Jim Cregan too. Jim Cregan was the guitarist who played that great guitar solo on Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile.
Oh, did he? That's one of my favourite ever songs, that. Come Up and Meet Me, Make Me Smile.
Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile. So Steve has promised to play that song live, to perform it live at my funeral. And every time I see him, he says to me, have you got a date yet?
That's a bit maudlin, Miss Jones. Goodness sake. Hope I'm not
It makes
there.
Us laugh. Humorous.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Okay. Right, okay, folks. That's it for another episode of Life on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. I hope you have a great day today, a great couple of days, until we resume talking to the millions of Life on Planet Porky fans out there, all of whom I wish happiness and heartfelt goodwill. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely. Anything you say, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, folks, till next time. I just don't like the appearance of a bald man. It unsettles me. I think a human head looks better with hair. So I've got great sympathy for people who lose their hair because of natural, you know, baldness. My dad was bald when he was 28. But I don't think going around shaving your head and all that kind of stuff is a very good look. And I'm glad that my prejudice has been held up by a report which says bald guys have a problem getting on in life. I just wonder what your image of the bald man is.
We'd better tell Prince William, hadn't we?
Prince William's not bald. He's going bald. Yeah.
Pretty much bald. He looks much better in a hat, I have to say. But I have a little list for you.
Oh, yes?
Okay. This goes way back. Oh. We're showing our age here. Telly Savalas.
Yeah,
Yul Brynner, James Taylor went bald, Andre Agassi, Moby, the techno artist, Jason Statham, Sir Patrick Stewart, Bruce Willis, Matt Lucas, Pablo Picasso, Dwayne Johnson, otherwise known as The Rock, Michael Jordan. I mean, how many do you want me to fling here?
But that doesn't mean I find them any more attractive as bald. You talk to the people, the security detail around them, who said that Boris Yeltsin is permanently pissed. Right? He drinks vodka like other people drink Coca-Cola or water. And half of the receptions that were held on for him, he never went to. Since when did Australia ever produce a decent singer apart from Michael Hutchence and Kylie Minogue?